From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
A collection of historic apples that was threatened by disease is having a second act at the New England Botanic Garden at Tower Hill in Boylston, Massachusetts, where a three-year-long restoration of their orchard of 119 antique varieties has just been completed. It's a story of going the distance to see those old varieties into the future in the age of climate change, and of what goes into making a successful, forward-looking orchard, from smart watering methods to native underplantings and more. So more in a moment, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top-quality spring-blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
Mark Richardson, New England Botanic Gardens Director of Horticulture, oversaw the recent apple orchard restoration project there, and he's here today to tell us more about what imperiled the collection of 119 antique varieties, what it took to save them, and lessons learned that can help gardeners who want to successfully grow fruit. Hi, Mark, and thanks for taking time out today to be with me.
Hi, Margaret. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, I remember the old orchard. You kind of come up the driveway, which is steep because the place used to be called Tower Hill, and that's still part of its name. And you drive up the hill, and I think it was kind of on the way up, wasn't it? It's on a slope, isn't it?
The orchard. It is, absolutely. It was one of the first things you could really see when you came around the corner as you traveled up the driveway to visit the garden before you got to the parking lot, before you, got out of your car to enter the garden. It was really, it marked the entrance to the garden quite well.
Yeah.
The orchard did.
And you joined New England Botanic Garden in 2018, I think, from Native Plant Trust, the former New England Wildflower Society. And the orchard was already in trouble. How old was it then? And set the scene for us, kind of what had happened when you arrived, like what was the uh-oh? What was the scene?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I joined the staff here in September of 2018 after spending about 6 years with the Native Plant Trust. And I was aware of the orchard and the sort of plight of the orchard. I moved to the area in 2012 to take the job at Native Plant Trust and got to know Joanne Vieira, who was my predecessor here, and,
yes,
and learned a little bit about the struggle that Joanne was having with trying to keep the apples going. It really, what happened was it right around 2010, the staff at the time saw the first widespread evidence of fire blight in the orchard. And, the orchard has a really long and rich history. It was started by a gentleman named Stearns Davenport, who was from the area. He had a small farm in South Grafton, Massachusetts, which is really just down the street from us here. And during the Great Depression, he was leading a WPA project under the guidance of working for the Massachusetts Department of Agriculture to cut down old unmanaged apple trees across the state. And it had a couple of different purposes. One was to provide jobs for people during the Depression. The other was to provide firewood for people. But what he realized was in some cases he was cutting down maybe the last representative of a unique variety of apple that really, grew no place else. And so he got to thinking and really wanted to try to preserve this piece of our cultural heritage by collecting apple trees of different varieties and growing them at his home orchard in Grafton. He started that work in the 30s and 40s, worked with some of the faculty at UMass to develop a list of, I think it was a list of 100 varieties that they really felt like were the most important to collect. And he set out to, find these. Some of them were really difficult to find. In some cases, there was, just a single tree that was out there. It was unique for some reason. He wanted to collect it. And so he set out to collect these trees from all over the place. His own personal collection by the time of his passing was right around 70 trees, 75 trees, I think, are what he had in his orchard in Grafton. And he was really forward thinking. He was a longtime supporter and member of the Worcester County Horticultural Society, which owns and operates the Botanic Garden here.
And it's either the oldest or one of the oldest such societies in the country, I think.
It
I
is.
Mean,
yeah,
it's a long history of horticulture.
Definitely. Long history. We used to be headquartered in Worcester. We moved to this location to become Tower Hill Botanic Garden in the mid 1980s.
Yes.
And by that time, Mr. Davenport had passed away. He passed away in, I believe, the early 1970s. But before he passed, he convinced, or I'll say he encouraged the Horticultural Society to take over management of his orchard. So we essentially have owned the trees since, I think, the 50s and 60s. And in the 60s and 70s, the orchard was actually moved to Old Sturbridge Village because the Horticultural Society didn't have its own piece of property to have an orchard. They worked with Old Sturbridge Village to kind of relocate the apple orchard so that it was no longer on Mr. Davenport's private property, but it was in a more public space and managed by Old Sturbridge Village.
It eventually made its way to what became Tower Hill.
It was one of the very first projects that happened here once the society bought the property here. And so by 1989-1990 is when the orchard was first planted, and it you know really did quite well for a period of almost 20 years before fire blight really moved in. And so at that point in 2010, the trees were around 20 years old. Many of them were really ravaged by fire blight. We had to go to pretty exhaustive lengths to protect the trees just to keep the germplasm alive. But we, at that point, ceased the scion distribution program. So for decades, we'd been collecting scion wood from the trees by request and distributing that wood so that other orchard enthusiasts could grow these really unique and special trees in their own orchards.
So let's just explain to people one of the reasons, you know, we've been talking about this collection that this gentleman had and then moving it to Sturbridge Village. You can't take a seed from an apple and make it the same apple tree. So it has to be asexual propagation, it has to be from wood, from scion wood, as you're just about to talk about, or you're just talking about. And that's the way that the same variety can be carried on through history, generation.
You've got it.
Yeah. And so it's literally a part of the old tree, you know, generation. You know, it's not a baby of the tree, it's part of the old tree.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, we have trees in the collection that date back to the 1600s.
Yes.
So that when you eat that apple, you're eating the same exact apple variety that someone in the 1600s was enjoying. So
I find
that really interesting.
And so fire blight is a bacterial disease, I think. And I think it strikes rose plants in the rose family. So not just apples and crab apples, but quinces and hawthorns and, I don't know, spireas and pears and shad, amelanchier, I think, and lots of other things, mountain ashes, sorbus, lots of other things. And it's something that we northern gardeners think about, you know, if we get it, it's like a little thing, it's not a big thing, it doesn't kill all the trees. More in the south, it can ravage things. But what happened? Why did this suddenly become a deadly situation for you?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, fire blight, it's endemic to our area. It's always been around, but it was always sort of more of a, you know, summer disease that we were concerned about when temperatures were pretty high. This is really a, you know, story of climate change playing out in unique ways. In 2010, if you go back and look at the temperature records from 2010, what you find is we had a really early stretch, or what was considered early at the time, a really early stretch of temperatures above 75 degrees Fahrenheit in early May. And at that time period, I mean, during that time period, when the temperature gets above 75 degrees and we've got humidity or moisture, or rainfall, at that time, fire blight becomes active. And what's interesting about the disease is it actually can carry, it can be carried on the back of a honeybee. And one of the ways that fire blight can get into an apple tree is through its blossoms. So if you find that your trees are blooming at the same time that fire blight is active, then you'll find that fire blight really moves through an orchard really quickly, jumping from tree to tree on the back of a honeybee as it's doing its very important work of pollination.
But in the north, if it's colder and cooler in the spring, that's not as likely to happen. Is that
exactly?
Right. Yeah. Right. So that sort of protected the north from the devastating version of this most of the time, I think.
That's right. Yeah. Once fire blight enters the vascular system of a tree, it can move really quickly. That's one of the reasons that it has the name fire blight. You know, and in fact, when you see evidence of fire blight on a tree, you typically want to prune out that infected wood. And you usually prune back about 2 feet toward the trunk of the tree from where you see the evidence of that damage because it moves so quickly through the vascular system. You've got to try to get ahead of it.
So I want to kind of just, you know, I want to get to some of the prescriptive and what's happened more recently and some of the forward looking stuff. So sort of fast forward, when you got there, they'd been treating the trees with, I think, streptomycin. And
that's right.
You know, that had limitations because you couldn't really eat the fruit because we don't know what the impact of that would be. And oh, my goodness. And as you said earlier, in 2011, they'd already stopped distributing scion wood, which was the point of having this collection, was to be able to share and keep it going on in many places for the future, into the future years. But so the decision was made, the treatment's not going to work, it's not the answer, we're going to take down the orchard. And that was, what, 3 years ago, maybe, or something?
Yeah, so I started in September of 2018, and one of the first people I met was a gentleman named John Bunker, who started Fedco Trees up in Maine.
Yes.
And John is a, you know, probably this region's foremost apple expert. He's just a brilliant mind, and his own personal collection of heirloom apples is about 300 trees deep. And
wow,
he's got a tremendous tremendous amount of work. His lifetime has really been dedicated to this work and preserving apple varieties and getting people excited about them. And John made it a point to come and meet with me pretty soon after I started here. I think maybe October, about a month after I started. And he sat me down and said, so I want to help you restore the apple orchard, but it means you're going to have to cut down all the trees. And
deep breath, Mark.
Yeah. So my next meeting was with our CEO, Grace Elton. And, you know, as someone who'd only been here for about a month or 6 weeks at that time, I felt pretty comfortable in going to her and saying that we had to cut down all the apple trees. You get a little bit of leeway when you first start in a new job. So I felt that she would receive it okay. And she did. And so we set out on this path to restore the orchard. And really what it came down to was John and his wife, Cammy, would come the following late winter, early spring, around February, March, and take about 10 pieces of scion wood off of every tree in the collection, which they did. They brought all that material back up to Maine. And Fedco is a cooperative, so they work with a lot of different local growers. And so our trees were grown by a nursery that grew, you know, small fruits, raspberries, blueberries, other apples, pears, you know, all sorts of different varieties of fruit trees. And so the grower there grafted all of our trees onto actually three different rootstocks. One is a fairly new rootstock that was developed through the Geneva station that's run by Cornell in New York, called G890. One was M111, which is a fairly old tried and true rootstock. And the other one was Antonovka. And Antonovka is a standard rootstock. All of our trees are grafted onto semi-dwarfing rootstocks, which means they'll get about 20 feet tall, and that's pretty much about it, which is exactly the size that we want them to be. But apples growing on a standard rootstock can get to be about 40 feet tall, maybe 50 feet tall.
And I have five of them in my garden that I inherited. You know, when I came here, they were already 100 and something, and now they're 150. And they're 35 feet tall and 40 feet across. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. So we did about 20 trees or 30 trees, excuse me, on Antonovka, and we planted them along the driveway
Right.
as you come up the hill toward the top of the toward where the parking lot is, because those standard rootstocks live quite a bit longer than the semi-dwarfing rootstocks will.
Yeah.
So you mentioned it sounded like your trees are around 150 years old,
yes,
which is
exactly.
what we hope these will live to be.
Yes.
So that's exciting that you've got some older apples in
yeah.
your home garden.
Yeah.
It's pretty
So those
great.
are near the driveway because it will be for the future generations of
Exactly.
visitors. It'll be this incredible thing to see the
Yeah.
big old
Yep.
apples. Yeah.
Yep, exactly. We know that we'll have to go through this process again. We know that, in 20 or 30 years' time, we'll have to reset the clock, if you will, and replace the trees in the collection. We hope to do so on a, sort of staggered schedule so that we maybe cut down a third or a quarter of the trees on a 3 or 4 year schedule so that we're not
Right.
taking them all down at the same time. But those grafted onto standard rootstocks will be here for, for generations,
Right.
which is pretty exciting.
So you're not going to have any fruit any days this fall. I mean, it's
No,
not like this is
definitely
no
not.
instant fix,
Nope.
but and you've backed up the collection in the sense that I imagine there's extra scion wood, whether it's up in Maine or whatever. It's all like it took a long time because you can't just say, oh, let's take some cuttings and then let's cut down the trees and that's that. It had to be where you knew that your scion wood was successfully creating these young baby trees in Maine,
Right.
and yeah, with a
Right.
several of each and or 10 of each, however many you said, and all that kind of good stuff for
Yep.
safety. Yeah,
Yep.
yeah, yeah,
Yep.
yeah.
Yep, that's right. And one thing we also did was Fedco grew a bunch of extra trees for us, and we sold a lot of those trees. So
Oh, that's
rather
sweet.
than just the scion wood that we've distributed in the past, we sold a couple of hundred trees that spring. So when our trees came in early 2021, we also had bundles and bundles of additional trees that that we had sold to people who were interested in growing these trees at home. So
How big
that's
were
great.
the trees when you got them from Fedco before? Yeah. How
Yeah.
what are we talking about? Is it like just a whip, so to speak, or
So
what is this?
yeah, they're a little bit more than a whip. So most of them were branched. Some of
Oh.
them were honestly, some of them were 8 to 9 feet tall,
Wow.
where others were just 3 or 4 feet tall. Remember, each variety is going to grow slightly different
Yes.
from the next. So we had some that were quite tall, some that were quite small. Really, just depended on the variety and how vigorous the growth is, but. But they're, the trees haven't put on a ton of size since we put them in. They all have a drip emitter for irrigation, so we can water it pretty efficiently without getting any water on the foliage. That would help to, sort of facilitate disease pressure.
Yes.
And yeah, we planted all of them last year with a ton of volunteer help, and we've got one volunteer in particular, a woman named Leslie Duffy, who spends really a couple of days a week out working in the orchard during the growing season, and couldn't have done it without her incredible help. So
So if I plant a young fruit tree, are you protecting it in the winter? Are you doing anything? I mean, I assume this is sort of an open area. It's not a fenced area, is it?
it's not, no, it's
Yeah.
not. So definitely some critters that would like to chew on the trunks of your
Yeah.
tree. Voles are a concern.
Yeah.
Deer are also a concern in our area.
Yeah.
We are in the process of putting a deer fence up around the whole entire garden, which
Wow.
will, help the apples, but also help the rest of the plant collection as well. But we definitely put a wrap around the trees in the winter. And that's to help with a little bit with rodent damage, but also with bucks. So bucks like to rub their antlers
Yes.
on the trunks of young
The
trees.
rut during the rut
Exactly.
season.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep. You've got it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So there's that, and that you said you put in a very focused watering system, a drip system for each plant.
We
And
did.
what's on the ground? I think it just used to be grass. I'm trying to visualize years ago seeing it, but it wasn't any, I don't remember. Was it just grass underneath the old trees?
Yeah, it was sort of minimally managed grass. We're
Yeah.
planting a pretty short sort of prairie around the trees. So
Oh.
lots of so ground cover strawberries, some great native plants. So Mihania, Prunella, Lots of different grasses. One of a grass that I really like a lot is called Andropogon glomeratus. It's the excuse me, I'm going to draw a blank on the common name, but it's one of our blue stems, bushy blue stem.
I was going to say it's a relative of little and big, right?
Yep, you've got it. Yeah, so it's a relative of little blue stem, big blue stem. It's still an Andropogon, but it's got this amazing seed head. The inflorescence on it is really cool. It only gets a maybe 18 to 24 inches tall. We'll probably mow a little bit earlier in the season just to keep it a little shorter than that. But lots of other grasses like Erigrostis, some Discampsia, few other things that can tolerate the sort of dry slope that the orchard is on, but also remain relatively low so that people can still, you know, get up close to all of the trees. We mow a sort of short mown path through it. Orientation or the direction of that path will probably change seasonally. And so, you know, it might be really circuitous one year, a little straighter the next year, every year, it'll be slightly different.
A new adventure each year.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. You've got it. Now when you're talking about this sort of underplanting, your history, not only with the Native Plant Trust, but also the fact that you're a co-author with Dan Wilder, who also worked there, of Native Plants for New England Gardens, which is a great reference book for people in the region.
Oh, thank you.
So it sounds like you're drawing on some of that expertise for sure in figuring out this ground level underplanting for this new wild orchard. Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, we want it to have seasonal interest. We want to make sure that we've got some, you know, not just flowers during the spring when the apples are blooming, but also flowers at different points during the season as well. Definitely a lot of plants that are fantastic for pollinator support. Pollinators are so important for apples and, you know, also all of the other plants that we like to enjoy. So we want to make sure that we're providing habitat for pollinators and other beneficial insects. But, you know, keeping the orchard relatively short so that it's easy enough for people to walk around. They're comfortable walking through the short grass meadow. So lots of different, reasons for the plants that we've selected, but certainly trying to go with a pretty exclusively native plant palette around the bottoms of the trees.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
And I think when we spoke the other day, you mentioned to me that adjacent to this, you're also planning to do sort of a beneficials border, this other planting, which I guess would also probably help the tree. Just tell us quickly about that.
Sure. Yeah. So, part of the apple orchard is adjacent to the lawn garden, which is our right. very formal, you know, major kind of feature, major formal garden. And there's historically been a minimally managed shrub border between the apple orchard and the lawn garden. And we're planning to renovate that that border, hopefully next spring, do some of the work this fall and into next spring. The idea there is to have something that's pretty low maintenance, really trying to build an area of the garden that supports wildlife habitat, specifically for beneficial insects, for not just pollinators, but also predatory insects for some challenging pest plants that we have. So there's some inspiration that we're looking at. There are a couple of British designers, one guy named Nigel Dunnett, another named James Hitchmau, who build these really elaborate walls out of found materials and rotting logs and, but make them look quite beautiful and stunning. So big sweeps of individual species that are selected for their, for their low maintenance, and also beneficial organism support, habitat support, and then also some, really interesting walls and features that we create ourselves throughout that border as well. So pretty excited. I think it'll be really beautiful once we're finished, and a nice kind of transition area between the very formal lawn garden and the orchard just beyond.
So in the last minute, I just was going to quickly ask, we talked about how the fire blight, because of the changing, shifting climate, the trees are more vulnerable. Excuse me. Any other climate change pressures, just quickly, that you're seeing at New England Botanic Garden that are on your list?
We spoke about it a little bit the other day. I mean, we've been in this just tremendous drought all season. It really started before the growing season started, and we've hardly seen any rain at all this year, and that's on the heels of about 18 inches of rain last July. So it seems like every year is, you know, there is no normal any longer. The wild weather swings are certainly a component of, the impact of climate change. And it's something we have to learn to live with. And, you know, it means building gardens that are resilient, selecting plants that can tolerate, you know, extended periods of drought, and also infrequent inundation with a ton of water when we get these downpours and, you know, really intense storms and off-season, you know, unusual weather patterns that we just haven't typically seen in our area. Basically all bets are off. We've really got to figure out how to garden in a changing climate, and it's a challenge. And so every year is a new challenge.
It sounds like your expertise in the native plant world is going to be helpful to you.
Sure.
So good. Well, thank you for making time today. I know you're always busy. And this is no different. It's still garden season. So thanks for making time, Mark. And I hope I'll speak to you again soon.
Oh, thank you so much, Margaret. This is great. It's a real pleasure talking to you.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon too. Now don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com. And on Facebook and on Instagram as @AwayToGarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.